Welcome into The Verge, a show which covers the Baltimore Orioles minor leagues. The Verge is part of BSL Radio. Baltimore Sports and Life is dedicated to analysis and discussion on the Orioles, Baltimore Ravens, and the University of Maryland. The site has a team of writers providing coverage of those teams and houses live streaming content weekly. Join the conversations at the message board, like BSL on Facebook, and follow BSL on Twitter.
Welcome to On the Verge. This is Zach Spedden, joined as always by Bob Phelan and Nick Stevens. On tonight's episode, we'll take a look at the playoff-bound Bowie Bay Sox and recap the High A, Low A, and Florida Complex League seasons. In addition, we'll get into a little bit of off-season preview talk and talk about which players we think the Orioles might target, how that could affect the rebuild, and maybe look a little bit further ahead to figure out exactly when we can count on the Orioles trading prospects to make their Major League roster better. All of that's coming up shortly here, but first, On the Verge is brought to you courtesy of Mercer Floor and Home Carpet One. Mercer is a third-generation family business that was established in 1959 and is located on Main Street in beautiful, historic downtown Westminster, Maryland. For all of your flooring needs, think Mercer. So as always, we want to shout out our patrons who support us over at Patreon, and we've got a couple new members this week. And Bob, who are they?
Yeah, we got two new ones this week. Taylor Sandroni is the first one. And sorry, I don't know how to pronounce the last name. Sam Lager. Congratulations to us to have you come on board. Thank you for joining us. And we're at 48 patrons now, two away from 50. I want to give away a free coffee cup to whoever comes up number 50. And if that doesn't persuade you, then I don't know what will.
We do have some very nice coffee mugs in stock here. So consider that if you haven't already. But we'll start off with the big news that happened on Sunday, which was the Bowie Bay Sox defeated the Altoona Curve to advance to the postseason and ended up coming down to the final day. But Bowie makes the playoffs after a really eventful season that saw basically five of the six Orioles top prospects, according to our current list, wear a Bay Sox uniform at one point, the only one being Colton Cowser, who was just drafted this year. Grayson Rodriguez had a dominant start last week. And it was really, you know, one of those teams that went through a lot of change, like every other minor league team we've seen this year, and yet managed to just stay good throughout on both sides of the ball. They had some guys come up and hit, like Kyle Stowers and Zach Watson, that really took us by surprise a little bit. Adley Rutschman was there for a long time and was obviously great. The pitching staff, you know, held up even after D.L. Hall went on the injured list, thanks in no small part to some reinforcements they received from High A Aberdeen, including guys like Drew Rahm and Kyle Bronowitz. So, Nick, I'll start with you as Bowie prepares for their postseason series against Akron, which begins on Tuesday. Thoughts on the Bay Sox season?
It's one of the best seasons down there on the farm this year, I think. It's what kept us sane, I think, instead of not focusing on the Major League roster so much. And, you know, Norfolk kind of struggled a little bit. They've had some issues and using some of the guys they've used. And, you know, Delmarva and Aberdeen were fun, but I think you saw a lot, like you mentioned, you saw a lot of the top talent in Bowie this year. And Sunday was a real testament to, I think, something that we've harped on a lot this year, the coaching staff that they've got down there in Bowie, and it's throughout the whole organization, but specifically what's going on in Bowie, I think it's a key level for minor league development, and I think they've got some really great personnel down there. And Sunday was just an unbelievable game, I think, just focusing on this past weekend. Like, I'm going to be honest and say I almost didn't tune in because Mickey Janis was on the mound. And you know, I had a lot of money that I lost yesterday watching week two of the NFL that I was going to focus on instead. But I said, nope, might be the last day I'm going to watch Bowie. And good thing I did because, I mean, these guys, the unsung heroes of the season, I think, really stepped up in a major way. It was the Zach Watsons who came out of nowhere this year. Johnny Reiser has been a solid contributor. Andrew Doshbach with a key hit there. Gunnar Henderson came up with a key hit at the very end of the game. I mean, it was the less heralded guys that really stepped up yesterday. And I think that's been the storyline for a lot of levels of the minor league season this year. And the biggest one was Cody Roberts, a guy who I'm sure not a lot of people have heard the name before. This journeyman catcher, minor league catcher kind of. But the bullpen was solid. It's great. This team was full of guys that this is their first year of pro ball. Your Garrett Stallings, Kyle Bronowitz, these guys, Jordan Westberg now. This is their first pro seasons, and now they're trying to win a championship here. And I think that says a lot. Even with Adley gone, Stowers, Nystrom, Bauman, the slew of pitchers that are all in Norfolk now, it's all gone. They're all gone. They're not in Bowie anymore, yet Bowie is still in his position to take home a championship this weekend. It's pretty awesome. I think it's really cool for these guys.
Yeah, I couldn't have said it better myself. And again, it goes to the coaching, because it's like it didn't matter who's in the lineup, who's on the mound. They're getting a job done this year. You know, you had Taron Vavra get hurt, Joey Ortiz get hurt, all the promotions, and yet it doesn't matter. Someone else was stepping up, like Vivek said in the chat, next man up. You had Toby Welk come in. He's had a mixed season, but he's had his moments. And like you said, Zach Watson, Andrew Dashbach, who saw that power surge coming in over the last month or so of the season. So just a lot of fun to watch. And yeah, I'd much rather watch the Billy Bay Sox any night of the week than the Baltimore Orioles, especially if you've seen that lineup that's going out there tonight.
Yeah, I would rather not see that lineup that's going out there tonight. But yeah, so Bowie will begin the AA Northeast Championship Series tomorrow night at Prince George's Stadium with Gray Fenter on the mound, getting the ball for the Bay Sox. 6:35 start. Be sure to head out to the ballpark if you're in the area or watch on MILB TV. And we'll be talking about Gray Fenter in a little while when we get down towards the end of the show. But for now, we'll move on. We'll talk about the teams whose seasons have ended, and that includes the Aberdeen Ironbirds, the Delmarva Shorebirds, and the Orioles' two Florida Complex League teams. Across the board, kind of an interesting mix for these teams. Aberdeen ended up finishing just under 500 at 58-61, but it probably doesn't tell the full story of how their season went. A lot of top prospects come through. They had Jordan Westberg and Gunnar Henderson on the left side of their infield for an extended period of time. Grayson Rodriguez dominated there at the start of the year. They saw good pitching performances from guys like Drew Rahm, Garrett Stallings, and Kyle Bronowitz. Before they were promoted to Bowie, that was where Joey Ortiz's breakout began this year. So all in all, a pretty interesting year for the Ironbirds. And I'll start with Bob, because I know that Bob had an opportunity to see the Ironbirds in person a few times this year.
Yeah, I did. And I think the thing for me is the pitching. Obviously, towards the end of the season, that kind of faded away just a bit. But especially early in the year when you had Grayson Rodriguez, Blaine Knight, all these guys that eventually ended up in AA Bowie's rotation, you got to see the early signs of what they were going to be able to provide at the upper levels. And I think that was pretty consistent all year. But the lineup, I think it was a little top-heavy early on in the season. And then once they lost a lot of their guys to Bowie, it wasn't quite as potent, especially towards the last month here when Gunnar Henderson and Jordan Westberg had moved up. But still some pretty good performances in players like T.T. Bowens. He ended the year pretty strong. He's another first base type that's going to be able to slug some home runs in this system over the next couple of years. So Maverick Hanley, I would have liked to see him stay a little bit more healthy this year, but at least defensively, I think he's just cemented that he is going to be in this organization as long as possible for that alone, and hopefully he can, you know, get the batting average and the hitting up a little bit over the next season or two.
Yeah, hitters-wise, it got kind of tough there at the end of the season. I think as far as like top prospects are concerned, definitely some under-the-radar guys. But same with pitching, too. I think you saw a lot of like Connor Gillespie, Jake Prezina, like these kind of guys. A lot of arms from the 2019 draft that are mostly relievers, your Garrett Farmers and Shelton Perkins and Cage Stroud, like a lot of these guys getting their first full season of work in, and some mixed results there. Easton Lucas, of course, I think all season down there in Aberdeen. I don't know if that John DeVillar trade is going to end up working out in the Orioles' favor, to be totally honest. But for me, the biggest thing, I looked at some numbers earlier today. You know, Aberdeen, yeah, they were three games below 500, but they finished second in their division, 12 and a half games back behind Hudson Valley, who's a Yankees affiliate, so that kind of stings a little bit. But they finished kind of slow, 2-8 to drop below 500 and a -9 run differential in the year. But when it comes to on the field play, walks. And I know Steve Molesky had an article today when he talked to Buck Britton, the Bowie Bay Sox manager, yesterday after they clinched the spot in the AA Northeast Championship Series. And Buck Britton specifically mentioned the walks that kind of sparked that late inning rally. The Ironbirds finished second in High East with 469 walks, fourth in doubles, first in triples. And so while they were in the bottom half of the league in most offensive categories, they actually were pretty good in waiting for their pitches and making good contact, doing damage when we did see them. And I honestly thought about what John Mioli said last week when he made a good point about, you know, talking about Jamai Jones and up at the major league level and how, you know, he's it seemed like pitchers found out that he's not swinging on those pitches inside on his hand, so that's where they've been pounding him. And when you're in the minor leagues, you know, you're probably being told you had a great day at the plate because you're not swinging at bad pitches. You're waiting for your pitch. You're doing damages on your pitches. So it's going to take time to see if this strategy works out and plans out in the long run, I think, as far as player development goes. But clearly a lot of great progress being made in Aberdeen. And the pitchers, second fewest walks in high A this year, eighth in strikeouts out of 12 teams, so kind of low in the strikeout total. But they did a great job of limiting free passes and had the third lowest whip in high A. So a lot of positives I think you could take away from Aberdeen season.
Yeah. I was just going to mention that's a good point about the walks, because I think that's when you saw Gunnar Henderson really start to walk more often, was when he got to Aberdeen, even when he wasn't hitting. So it seems like maybe Aberdeen is the step in the development where you're going to learn to walk, you're going to learn to wait for your pitch, and then obviously they will continue that growth up the ladder.
Yeah, I agree with you, Bob. And to kind of piggyback off of that, Kyle Stowers is another name that popped into my head as far as like the walks, because we started to see him take more walks at Aberdeen. You know, his overall, his overall numbers were better at Bowie than they were at Aberdeen. But that trend of him waiting for his pitch and drawing the walks came through. And then he moves to what was really the more hitter-friendly park this year in Bowie as compared to Aberdeen. And then the power comes right along with it. So a lot of positive steps were taken at Aberdeen this year by several players. So Stowers, Jordan Westberg, Gunnar Henderson, JD Mundy's another guy you could throw in that group with the year that he had. To hit 11 home runs in that ballpark is pretty impressive.
Very impressive. Yeah. And yet it's hard to remember sometimes, but you know, this is a system of development, not necessarily let's see who can put up the best numbers, the best stats. So I think they have something in mind for each guy, you know, each step along the way. And Aberdeen seems like a good point for that, especially with that ballpark not being very hitter friendly.
Yeah, I mean, and we're going to go into, you know, deeper dives, kind of into season thoughts on specific players, I think, kind of later on throughout the offseason. But, I mean, just looking at the pitching when they were down there, like Garrett Stallings, 8-3, a 4.39 ERA, ton of strikeouts, 12 walks in 80 innings. Drew Rahm was perfect, 8-0 with a 2.79 ERA, 73 strikeouts, 17 walks in 67 innings. Zach Peake finished the season. We'll talk about him in a minute, too. Brandon Young also finished the season just dominant in high A. And actually made a note earlier, I think it was over the weekend. Let me find this here. But I think a lot of this comes down to one. You mentioned Kyle Stowers as well. It falls into this category. One significant change in the organization is this culture change that John Mueller touched on last week. And we heard it from Ryan Fuller earlier this season when we met with him at Bowie. And he said how like the instructors and coaches are always talking with players at other levels of the organization as well, not just their guys in Bowie or their guys in Aberdeen. And everyone seems to be on the same page. And so like if players get promoted from Aberdeen to Bowie or Delmarva to Aberdeen, like it's not, you know, the coaches aren't like, all right, I'm done with you. My job is done. If you fail, like that's on the next side. That's on Ryan Fuller. If you get to Bowie and fail, because I did my job in Aberdeen. But, you know, there's defined goals and clear paths for all these players to follow. So when they get promoted, it's this really seamless transition. And so they're working with coaches they've been in contact with. Their plan is in place, and the organization goals, the coaches' goals, the players' goals, they're all aligned. They all seem to be transparent. Everyone's working toward those same goals. You know, there's no guarantee that all this is going to work, but, you know, I feel like if it doesn't, you know, we don't have this tremendous audience that we have anymore, but that's a whole other story. But the early returns are positive, and the growth and development that we've seen take place in 2021 far exceed any regressions and disappointments that we saw. And I'll be the first to admit, we did see a lot of the big disappointments this year as well, but that's just something that popped into my mind when we're talking about all the guys who had great seasons in Aberdeen.
Yeah, completely agree. And we'll move on now to Delmarva, who I think had probably, they missed the playoffs, but you could argue they may have had the most exciting season outside of Bowie of any team in the Orioles farm system. They start the year off with a loaded infield of Anthony Servideo, Daryl Hernandez, JD Mundy, Gunnar Henderson, Jordan Westberg. Little by little, those players either move on or, in the case of Servideo, get hurt. But then after a while, the 2021 draft class arrives, and here comes Colton Cowser, Billy Cook, Connor Norby, John Rhodes, Reed Trimble, and Kobe Mayo, who I think exceeded even some of the loftiest expectations for him this year. by just flat out raking between the Florida Complex League and Delmarva. It was not just all about the hitting, though, because some of the guys that we talked about a little bit ago in Brandon Young and Zach Peake actually started their success at Delmarva this year before going to Aberdeen. And before the season started, one of the biggest question marks that the three of us had looking throughout the whole farm system was Delmarva's pitching staff, because it was a lot of 2019 draftees, guys that had come over in trades from the Angels that we just didn't have a lot of information on. And in the end, it ended up being one of the stronger points, I think, in the farm system when you look at how Delmarva pitched throughout the year and how some of those players performed when they got there before they moved up.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I don't think we saw guys like Noah DeNoyer and Houston Roth, you know, coming out. And Houston Roth has struggled a little bit at the end of the year, but these guys just coming out and shoving it the whole year. And Brandon Young, another undrafted free agent signing, pitched great. Gene Pinto came up and became everybody's favorite player. Zach Peake, he actually pitched better in high A than he did in Delmarva, at least pure numbers wise. But, it's just all these guys that we didn't expect a ton from, and they came out and they put themselves on the radar. Even if it's just as a future reliever, potentially at the major league level, it was still fun to see.
Yeah, just more seamless transitions for those guys from the FCL to Delmarva. 68-52 record, fourth best record in low A East, but second best run differential. They piled on the runs when they got hot. Third in home runs. I know they set a lot of, Delmarva team-specific records this year in like 30 or 40 fewer games this year. And another big takeaway was, same thing, the walks. They finished second in walks, 573 walks on the year. Top four in the league in batting average, on-base percentage, and OPS. And you mentioned the pitching as well as they did. Second lowest ERA in the low A division that they were in. So, I mean, you just saw the biggest thing for me, and when I watched Delmarva as the season closed, I wish a lot of those guys would have been promoted to high A. And I'm typically very slow. Like, I will sit back and say, Colton Cowser stay in the FCL for the rest of this year. Like, I'm fine with that. Like, that's normally what kind of person I am when I look at this. But I'm here still thinking Colton Cowser should have been, like, up in Bowie right now for this playoff push. But clearly a lot of great hitting instruction and pitching instruction going on in Delmarva. And you saw Noah DeNoyer undrafted after 40 rounds in 2019. He's pitching better in high A as well. You mentioned Zach Peake pitching better in high A. Delmarva did a fantastic job of preparing guys for high A ball and putting themselves in a good position to succeed. And so you're not seeing, I mean, how many guys can you think off the top of your head that once they got promoted, other than Gunner to, high A for a little bit there, how many of those guys really struggled this year when they got up to Aberdeen from Delmarva?
Ignacio Feliz.
We weren't going to mention him anymore. that one does hurt. But yeah, I mean, that's two. You're talking about a minor league Rule 5 guy and then Gunnar Henderson, who eventually got promoted to Bowie. Yeah. So, I mean, it's fantastic development. I don't think we can stress that enough. Again, long-term is all that's going to work out. We don't know yet, but baby steps. And right now they're conquering those baby steps.
And Griffin McLarty also pitched better in high A than he did in low A. And another thing that I loved about Delmarva this year is you got to see a bunch of guys not just come out of nowhere, like the 2021 draftees and guys like T.T. Bowens, but guys who we thought long and dead in this organization, like Gene Carmona, or a guy coming back from brutal injuries and really just grinding his way back, like Lamar Sparks, and putting up impressive numbers and earning promotions to the next level, not just being handed it to them on a silver platter. So that was pretty cool to see.
Yeah, that definitely was a really cool part of Delmarva's season, being able to see guys like Carmona and Sparks get back on the field. The one thing I find interesting with Delmarva is that they finished with the second fewest strikeouts in low A East. And you hear a lot about how the Orioles kind of have this favoritism towards these swing and miss type players. Yet you look at some of the guys in Delmarva, like Darryl Hernáiz, and Hernáiz didn't walk. I could do a whole show trying to pick apart why that happened this year. But the guy never struck out. Colton Cowser never strikes out. Connor Norby really didn't strike out either. So you saw a lot of guys go there that I think fit a different mold that the Orioles were developing, which is very contact-oriented, some power, but that's not the main focus, and where maybe the system's a little more balanced than it's given credit for in that respect.
Yeah, I'm looking here, and the only guy who struck out more than 100 times was Mason Janvrin. And he arguably has the top speed, the most elite speed in the organization, but, I mean, Mason Janvrin's probably not going to make it above, Aberdeen level. So, I mean, that's okay. The big power hitters, that's what surprised me the most. guys like Christopher Cespedes and T.T. Bowens, you mentioned J.D. Mundy. These guys, if I'm being completely honest, like, I love T.T. Bowens coming up as a UDFA. We saw the videos, these just monster home runs he hit at Central Connecticut State. I think he came out of college from. And I was very wary of what, like, those three guys in specific would be able to produce, even at the Delmarva level. I thought 220, 230 batting averages, an extreme amount of strikeouts. And, yeah, they're going to crush baseballs, but if you hit 15 home runs and you're hitting 210 with 80 strikeouts in 50 games, like, that's not going to play at high A. But all three of those guys are in double A or high A and all finish the season. Mundy finished season on the IL, but Cespedes and Bowens are hitting even better in high A right now. So that was one of the biggest, most pleasant surprises for me, was the power hitters not striking out as much as I thought they would.
Even Kobe Mayo, who's 19 years old in low A, only struck out 26 times in 106 at bats with 16 walks. So close to a 20% strikeout rate for a 19-year-old slugger. That's pretty darn impressive. Can't wait to watch him hit bombs in Aberdeen next year.
That's very good, especially for someone where I think that overall hit tool was the big question mark coming into the season. For him to not strike out that much is really impressive. I want to bring up another point, too, and I think Delmarva does kind of tie into this, particularly with a guy like T.T. Bowens. I thought across the board, the Orioles farm system was much stronger at first base this year than what I was expecting, because it seemed like when you looked at the depth chart coming into the year, it was a really top-heavy position. A lot of guys in the majors that could play first base and hit for power. Some guys at AAA that could play first base and hit for power. And then just one question mark after the other, where guy who didn't have much of a track record, you didn't know what to expect, really at every level of the system once you got beyond that. But then you saw Mundy, Dasbach, T.T. Bowens, even Patrick Dorian playing a little bit at first this year, put up big numbers, and that was a surprise to me.
Yeah, Toby Welk too. But yeah, it's J.D. Mundy, T.T. Bowens, and Jacob Teeter even comes in and immediately is like raking. Yeah, never seen anything like it in the Orioles organization from pretty much top to bottom now. You know, it might not be future major leaguers. It's hard to, you know, start your minor league career as a first baseman and make it all the way through. It's a tough position to do that. You have to really rake. But even J.C. Ascara had a pretty good year. So just a great year for first baseman in the Baltimore Orioles organization, from Trey Mancini and Ryan Mountcastle all the way down to Jacob Teeter.
Yeah, I remember 2 years ago, 3 years ago, I mean, they were converting Preston Palmeiro to first base. And I actually really liked Preston Palmeiro when he came up as a second baseman in the lower levels of the minor leagues. Then they moved this guy who was like, I don't even think he was 6 feet tall. If he was listed at 6 feet, I think they're lying. Him trying to play first base, he didn't really have much power. And now you've got all these guys who are just mashers at first base. And they play pretty good defense. Jacob Teeter plays a good defense over at first base. But no one mentioned like the guy at the top of the list. I mean, Ryan Ripken had a couple of key hits for Norfolk guys. I mean, that swing is something. I'll just leave it at that. It's something.
I want to just say he had a better season than Yusnel Diaz. Boom.
You know what? Actually, I'm going to cry now because I think that might be an accurate statement.
It is like, an accurate statement. I saw that this morning.
That is a fairly accurate statement. And I think if anyone's listening right now, if you cringe, that's rightfully so.
Now that we've talked about that, can we talk about two Florida Complex League teams that finished under 500?
Absolutely.
Sure. Okay, so Florida, as I just mentioned, Florida Complex League Orioles, both teams finished below 500. Orioles Black goes 18-28. Orioles Orange goes 11-34. Win-loss records for neither team was great, but still a ton of talent went through the Florida Complex League this year. Kobe Mayo was really the big one out of the gate. You obviously had a lot of the 2021 draft picks start out at the Florida Complex League before making their way to Delmarva. But there was more to it than that. We saw Misael De Sion break out and I think become one of those guys now that you feel like is knocking on the door of the top 30. Steven Acevedo put together a nice year. We finally got to see Luis Gonzalez and Luis Ortiz stateside, along with a few other notable prospects this year. And I think really, if you look at the Florida Complex League top to bottom, it was a reminder of the fact that the Orioles are actually building something of a nucleus of talent from the Dominican Republic and from Latin American countries, because we haven't seen it before. But now between some of the trades that were made under Michael Elias and some of the signings they've made, we're seeing that a little bit more. And although the Dominican Summer League was really where I think we had our attention focused on guys like Michael Hernandez and Samuel Basayo, we saw a lot of the Florida Complex League as well.
Yeah. Oh, go ahead, Nick.
I was going to say, if Eric's in here, jump in, and I see the comment he is here. Shout out to him for the videos. I mean, he's the eyes for Orioles fans down there in Sarasota, so we could actually see these guys. And I think, and Eric, correct me if I'm wrong, if you're listening, but I believe at the beginning of the year when the season started, at least on one of the teams, whichever one Kobe Mayo was on, I believe he was the only non-international player on the roster. And so I think that does speak volumes. We'll see if the talent pans out. There's certainly a lot of flashes of that talent so far, but just the fact that Kobe Mayo was one of the very few domestic prospects that the Orioles had on those rosters is pretty promising. You know, it's instructional ball. And Eric mentioned that a lot when he was on our show, and go back and listen to that episode for updates on a lot of these guys. And I guess it's really young. A lot of these guys are still 18, 19 years old. And I believe Kyle Glazer made this statement when he was on the show about these are the kind of guys that are probably going to get hurt the most with having 2020 wiped out. And then this year, when you look at some of the numbers, a lot of these guys in the FCL only saw like 35 or 40 games worth of action. So still not a whole lot this year. So hopefully the classroom instruction was valuable, and the drill work was valuable, and all the behind the scenes work was positive. And we see standouts like Steven Acevedo, Luis Gonzalez, Isaac De Leon. Moises Ramirez was a name that I know we saw a lot of on videos and box scores, and Roller in Hell. Hopefully we see all these guys start in Delmarva next year, and they can finally get 100-plus games under their belt. We can learn a lot more.
Yeah, absolutely. And, yeah, I don't know how important record is in general in the minor leagues, but especially in the FCL, I don't know how meaningful it is, but there's still plenty of talent that we have not really seen much of in the FCL for the Orioles. You know, we didn't even mention Isaac De Leon, I don't think. He had a pretty great season. And I won't forget one of my favorite days of the year following the minor leagues this season was that first couple of games when all the 2021 draft picks started playing. And it was just like, I don't know, every single person that came up to plate, it was like Eric Birdland was 100% of my Twitter feed that day. It was great. I loved to watch it. And then they went up and did the same thing in Delmarva. So win or loss, I had a lot of fun following the FCL this year.
Yeah, De Leon is actually a guy that I'm glad you mentioned, Bob. That was a player the Orioles acquired from Miami Marlins in 2020 in exchange for Richard Bleier. 19 years old, put together a very good season, 145 at-bats at the Florida Complex League this year, hit .276 with a .740 OPS, currently listed at 6'2", 170 pounds. If you listen to some of our episodes around the time the FCL started, we noted that Joe Trezza had written a good piece about De Leon, talking about his size a little bit and the question of whether he'll move off a shortstop, which is a long way down the line from being answered. But early returns on him this season were very positive.
Yeah, I know Eric was pretty positive on his footwork and smoothness at the position, at least at his age. Obviously, he could still grow out of it.
Yeah, and I think, too, a lot of these guys are probably going to end up, they still got half a season of instruction down there. I'm sure they're already down there in Sarasota, so I'm sure when the instructional camp starts in a couple of weeks, they'll all be down there as well playing games. So, the work doesn't stop just because the season's over. It's just beginning for these kids. And most of them aren't even going to be 20 yet, or barely 20, when they get into Delmarva next year. So you have this large group of college outfielders that, Orioles drafted, and half the draft is outfielders. So those guys are going to move quickly. Those are the guys you're going to see fill the Aberdeen roster next year. Maybe a Cowser slips in at Bowie to start the year, hopefully. But a lot of these guys in the FCL, they're going to have, if it takes them all year to work it things out Delmarva, like that's fine because they're still going to be 20 years old next year. So very, very young as well.
And I'm still excited to see Elio Prado play. Didn't get the chance to make his FCL. He might have played FCL when they first traded for him, or maybe it was DSL. I don't know. But we didn't get a chance to get to see him this year. So looking forward to, I'm sure he'll be back in the FCL just to get his feet wet next year. Hopefully he can rise up fast.
So we just talked about the Florida Complex League and Delmarva and didn't really talk about Gene Pinto much. And Pinto is not on our list for the final segment of the episode. So I kind of thought that I would check in because if you've been listening to the show since the start of July, you know it's pretty much become a Gene Pinto watch around here. This season, the young right-hander went 2-2 over 66 2/3 innings pitched with a 2.3 ERA, striking out 84, walking 17. That included a 46 2/3 innings run at Delmarva, where he walked just 13 against 56 strikeouts. His last outing of the year was not great, but when your season is that good, who really cares? And as a reminder, Pinto was sort of the guy regarded as the throw-in in the Jose Iglesias trade over the offseason and also brought Garrett Stallings over. He puts together this really impressive year at age 20. I have to think right now is in a position to start 2022 at Aberdeen as a 21-year-old, which is impressive, especially for a guy with such little experience in pro ball. So any words on Gene Pinto's season from either of you?
Well, you know, he had a pretty disappointing start, or not even start. He couldn't even start. He was so bad. He was a reliever. No, I'm still in the Pinto bandwagon. I can't wait to go watch him start opening day for the Ironbirds next season. And just like Drew Rahm, get up to Bowie by midseason and be a top 10 prospect in this organization.
Yeah, I mean, just no innings, 12 innings in 2019. That was it. That's all he's thrown coming into this season. So, looking at his Delmarva numbers, trying to get him to load here. My computer's being weird. He struck out 31% of hitters he faced just in Delmarva. We're not even looking at the Florida Complex League numbers. Only a 7% walk rate, huge ground ball numbers like 54, 55%. He only allowed one home run in 46 2/3 innings. And I know that's lower level ball, but still, that's impressive. A 0.90 whip. I mean, the kid works so fast, keeps the ball down. Guys can't square him up. Full of energy out there, too. And I think we need 1,000 Gene Pintos. If every pitcher pitched like Gene Pinto, baseball would be such an amazing sport to watch. I think he's a really special talent. And, you know, we've had someone, Kyle Glazer, didn't seem very high on him. I think his reports were outdated. I think that Gene Pinto is a rising star in this system. And like you mentioned, he's probably going to be the opening day starter in Aberdeen next year at 20 years old still. And could be another fast riser. And even if you move him to the bullpen and he has to do that and he has to fill that role, I think he's going to be a very powerful late inning arm at the next level. So,
and you didn't even mention the fact that it seems like even when he goes 5-6 innings, he only throws like 60 pitches. So for anyone, it's like, how come these pitchers these days can't go past 6 innings? Well, maybe Pinto could be that guy to go 7 every time out because he just throws strikes, pounds the zone, works fast. So, he's a hero.
Yeah, so Pinto certainly put together a really remarkable season. And if you didn't hear a player's name mentioned or you didn't hear a particular part of a season mentioned in this sort of recap that we did, don't worry because we have a whole offseason in front of us. And unlike last offseason, we're going to be recording weekly throughout this offseason. So we'll have a lot of time to get to individual players, talk a little bit more about these teams. But for now, this was kind of the broad overview of the seasons in the Florida Complex League, Delmarva and Aberdeen. And when they wrap up completely, we'll take a closer look at Norfolk, Bowie, and the two Dominican Summer League teams.
And if you're a patron, make it daily because we're going to talk about a single player every single day over the offseason. So sign up for patron and you can get a load of that.
Exactly. So another incentive to sign up that and a coffee mug. So we'll now get into kind of a different topic for us, which is trading players at some point, you know, trading from the farm system to get major league talent. We know that it's part of a rebuild. It's coming at some point. The question is when. And we do have a listener question that I want to get to in a moment. But first, I'll start off with our friends over at The Warehouse, part of Baltimore Sports and Life Radio here. Had a conversation on their most recent episode about this topic. And Stephen Loftus, who is our as our listeners know, resident draft expert, very smart guy here at Baltimore Sports and Life, brought up two names that I thought were interesting as possible offseason trade targets for the Orioles that would improve the major league club and probably not require giving up more than a mid-tier prospect. Marlins third baseman Brian Anderson, who is currently on the 60-day IL, and Joey Wendell of the Tampa Bay Rays. Now, if you're asking yourself, who is Joey Wendell? The answer is he's one of those typical Rays players that plays like 9 positions on the field. You didn't hear of him 5 minutes ago, and now he's 3-for-4 against your team. So that's a way to describe Wendell in a nutshell. But those are two names that he brought up. We've kind of speculated our own names here as far as maybe they go out and they sign a Kyle Seager or an Eduardo Escobar. I do think regardless of third base needs to be a priority this offseason in some way, shape, or form. But I'll start with Nick on this topic. Do you think that this is an offseason where we see maybe some prospects move, not the top guys, but some guys from the minor league system move to improve this major league roster?
Not this offseason, I don't think. Of course, we do realize that time is coming. I kind of can't wait. You know, I love following these minor league guys, and getting to know them has been awesome, interacting with them this year and watching them play on a nightly basis. But I know the time is coming. I hope the time is coming where we turn into the San Diego Padres the last 2 years, where if we trade all these guys and end up getting the Yu Darvish, the Michael Clevengers, I don't even know who else the Padres traded for. They traded their entire farm system and acquired half a new major league roster, but still kept Mackenzie Gore, CJ Abrams, Luis Camposano there, so they keep their top guys. You know, I'm hoping that day comes very, very soon. And maybe like Vivek says, maybe it is 1 year away. I hope that is the case. But I don't think it's this offseason. I do, though, think that maybe, and we're going to talk about this on an episode soon, an episode that I think all three of us are very much looking forward to, there's a very, very long list of Rule 5 eligible guys coming up that the Orioles going to have to make decisions on. So, I mean, maybe if you think about moving those guys, if someone's really high on Blaine Knight and you just don't think there's enough room to protect Blaine Knight, which I know you look at this major league roster, that sounds crazy that there's not going to be any room to protect anybody, but it's a very long list. And so if you think maybe, you know, Blaine Knight, if we leave him out there at the Rule 5 draft, he's going to be selected. If another team's high on him, we can maybe move him. You know, that's an example I can think of right there. But, you know, these top guys are still another year away of finding out more about them and what exactly their role at the major league level is going to be. So this isn't also to trade those top guys. But I think definitely some of these Rule 5 eligible guys, maybe keep an eye on them as possible moves.
Yeah, that's interesting. I could maybe see a Blaine Knight for Joey Wendell type trade. I think the Rays could probably do some magic with Blaine. Joey Wendell, that is an interesting guy. He's got like a mid 750s OPS for a guy that can play any position all over the infield, 31 years old. But yeah, I do think we're like a year away from really doing something like that, going all in at least on a massive upgrade. And it's so hard to predict right now because all the guys that are towards the top of our prospect rankings are guys that I want to see at least, you know, another season of development under our watch, see where we go. And then the guys like Yusnel Diaz and Adam Halls, who have fallen off our radar, I'm sure they've fallen off the other team's radars as well. So one guy I had in mind, kind of similar to a Joey Wendell type, and it actually reminds me of the J.J. Hardy trade from back in the day, is Paul DeJong for the St. Louis Cardinals. He's, you know, power-hitting, good defensive shortstop who's coming off of back-to-back disappointing seasons. Right now he's batting 197 with a 673 OPS, but he's got power. He's got 17 home runs, and he's only 28 years old, and he is under contract for two more years and then two team options after that. So if that's a guy they like, that could definitely be something that maybe it wouldn't take too much to get a hold of him. I don't know what you guys think about that.
My response, I said before the show, like, I haven't looked at a box score this year at the major league level. I haven't watched a game. Like, I'm so out of the loop. And so I feel like my response is going to be, like, pretty much anything's going to be an upgrade. Yeah, I like Paul DeJong. Looking at his numbers now, I like that power for sure. 17 home runs this year and only 103 games. I think guys like that could be good targets. They're going to be an improvement. They're going to be cheap. It's not going to be an issue trading away a mid-level prospect for someone like that who's going to make the major league roster better until a Jordan Westberg or Gunnar Henderson steps up and maybe they take over that third base role. But, I mean, those are definitely good options. And it's definitely, when you're looking at other names, positional versatility, I think, is still going to be the name of the game. So if they can play more than one position as well, for sure, you know that guy's going to be on Michael Hatch's radar.
Yeah, because that's kind of the trend that the Orioles have taken so far with their infielders, is they are trying to make these guys more versatile. So a guy like a DeJong or Wendell would fit that mold a little bit more because they can play multiple spots. I think that if you are going to trade, you need to go after a guy like that who is not necessarily going to be, you know, your third baseman for the next 5 years or whatever infield position you're bringing him into play. But if he makes you better for the next year or two while you're waiting for a Gunnar Henderson or a Jordan Westberg or a Joey Ortiz or whoever to get to the major leagues, that's better than having to go to the bottom of the free agent class at those positions every offseason and bring guys in. And it kind of takes us back to something John Mioli said last week when he was on, which is that maybe the financial flexibility the Orioles have allows them to do things like go get a better version of Matt Harvey, which, you know, basically means that you can pay a little bit more to get a pitcher that's going to do better than what Matt Harvey did this year. And again, I know that's a low bar, but
still. How's that possible? Come on.
But still, we got, you know, we got to move forward here somehow. One thing I really want the Orioles to do this offseason, and I thought that they were on this track last offseason, and it really didn't work. That infield defense has to get better, especially second and third. I think the Ramon Urias is going to be capable where you put him, you know, wherever you want to put him. I think Ryan Mountcastle is getting better at first base. We know that Adley Rutschman will make the catcher's position better the second he arrives. When Austin Hayes and Cedric Mullins are out there, that's two-thirds of a great outfield. If Anthony Santander is back next year and healthy, you've got a really good defensive outfield. But the infield defense has to get better, and that's – I have a lot of reservations because of Anderson's injury. He has a shoulder problem right now. But one thing I will say in his favor is that when he's been healthy, he's generally rated as a good defender. And in 2019, I think he had 20 homers at what's generally regarded as a pitcher's park down in Miami. So you bring him here, probably hits 260. But if he gets you good defense, 25 homers, and he does that for the next 2 years while you're waiting for someone else to take over third, I would be okay giving up a mid-level prospect for that.
Yeah, and I think ideally we need two infielders. I think Urias and Mateo could split or combine for one of the three, second, short, and third, and then say you trade for a Paul DeJong, a Joey Wendell, and then you sign Eduardo Escobar, or you trade for Brian Anderson. I think that's what ideally would need, like two guys on a 1 or 2 year deal type of thing while you wait for Westberg's and the infield depth, like you said, to come up. But yeah, Brian Anderson, as long as that's a minor injury and he can get healthy, or maybe that even lowers his price tag, it's not a bad angle. Or you keep Kelvin Gutierrez, who can hit his way out of a paper bag, but he plays great defense.
I think the issue, though, is just that. Like, Kelvin Gutierrez makes some fantastic plays. He did it in Norfolk, you know, watching him there. And he's doing it at the major league level as well. But you look at Norfolk's roster right now, well, go even lower, look at Bowie's roster. Like, yeah, there's Patrick Dorian. And I know a lot of – there have been some people who, you know, have said maybe the defense isn't all that great. I think it's better than what some people have said it is. But as far as, like, being an everyday major league third baseman, I don't know. And he didn't play any at AAA this year, so we know Michael Elias likes to, you know, make your stop at each level. But looking at Norfolk, like, there's really no one that's, I think, going to step up and take one of those starting spots, infield spots next year. Like, there's the Jamiah Jones question, which I think could be still a whole podcast in of itself, or people are just tired talking about Jamiah Jones and we can move on. But Mason McCoy would improve the defense, but he can't hit very well. Ryland Bannon can improve the defense, I think, if you put him at second base, but he hasn't hit very well this year. JC Escarra is strictly a first base prospect. And so there's really no one else on that infield that's coming next year. 2 years from now, yes. 3 years from now, for sure. But next year, no. So I do agree. You're going to have to get two infielders this year and do something.
Yeah, I mean, your best case scenario, I think, out of the farm system is either that Jamiah Jones could figure it out to plate and he takes over at second base at some point. And I had mixed reaction to his defense during his time in the major leagues. I think he has good reins, but it doesn't necessarily translate into him being a great defensive second baseman. So he needs a lot of work. But then Terran Vavra, you know, that's a guy that I could see in the mix if he's healthy. He's, you know, if with better health next year, if he goes to Norfolk and does what Terran Vavra does, which is just flat out hit, never strike out, get on base, play solid defense, he could be the second baseman by the All-Star break. But he's going to need time at Norfolk. He's not going to be ready on opening day to play in the major leagues. I think he's going to need good time down in the minors next year.
Yeah, I agree. I could see Terran Vavra starting in AAA and then maybe forcing his way up eventually. But I still say you get two guys in here and then you just trade one of them when the time comes. Because, I mean, I don't think Elias is going to rush these guys up. I think he wants to get them perfectly seasoned. He seems to like to get them, you know, ready to contribute as soon as they come up.
Yeah, I forgot about Vavra, but that's because of the injuries. And hopefully he can make it to the Arizona Fall League in a couple of weeks and get some more at-bats. Yeah, Vivek is asking, is there an Arizona Fall League? There is. I've seen some trickling of some names from other teams being announced unofficially, but nothing from the Orioles yet, which I'm sure they're going to keep that very under wraps, as much as maybe we can start trying to pry a little bit. I know we got some listeners that will know more. We'll start prying here hopefully soon. But yeah, I forgot about Vavra. Hopefully he gets down there and gets more bats. But yeah, he didn't really get to play that much. Joey Ortiz got hurt, missed pretty much the whole season. He could have been an option, I think, next year, but that injury set him back. And the only other name I guess you could look at is Caden Grenier. But again, he also doesn't hit the ball very well, at least consistently. And we know the strikeouts are a big issue there. While he would be the best defender on that Orioles infield right now, again, it's an issue with so many other guys. Like I just mentioned, it's hitting is the issue.
Yeah, and I think that's a fair point, because if they had, you know, if making the infield defense had been the number one priority, don't worry if they hit 200. Mason McCoy, Richie Martin would have had substantial time in the major leagues this year. Caden Grenier probably would have gotten there. But, yeah, I think that they couldn't quite find that balance of get a guy with a good glove who can be a replacement-level bat. They just couldn't find that option out there. Yolmer Sanchez was not that guy, obviously. Freddie Galvis was that guy until he got hurt and then traded. It's something that I think they have to do. I admit that there's not an easy way to do it, but I think that if you're going to have a lot of young pitchers next year, you need that infield defense to be better.
And maybe this is crazy, but I feel like if Joey Ortiz didn't get hurt, maybe he starts the 2022 season as a Baltimore Oriole at the major league level, or at least knocking on the door at AAA, not too far behind.
Oh,
just defensively alone. Yeah,
I don't think that's crazy at all. I mean, with the way that he was hitting, and we've known for years how good his defense is, the way that he was hitting when he got hurt, I think that's very possible. So Vivek asked this question: would you welcome Freddie Galvis or Jose Iglesias again for shortstop and then Escobar for third base? So I guess referring to Eduardo Escobar.
I wouldn't hate it. I mean, I think I'd prefer Iglesias over Galvis in that scenario, especially if their prices are similar, but I wouldn't hate that at all.
Yeah, I mean, I'm fine with I'd probably prefer Escobar maybe, because I feel like, not looking at the numbers in front of me, I feel like offensively he provides more, if I'm not mistaken.
28 home runs this year.
There you go. Perfect. So, yeah, I'll take that for sure. Galvis, I'd probably, like, if I were to rank him, I'd say Escobar 1, like Iglesias 2. The defense was pretty good, and we didn't really get to see him play shortstop a whole lot because of his injury when he was here. So, and if he can get us another Gene Pinto-type player, then bring Jose Iglesias back for sure. Or another name, too. I think I heard this one out there. I don't know what he's done this year. He might be pretty much on the way out the door, or what his contract situation is. But in Andrelton Simmons, I don't know if he's still out there or available, but I don't think I've heard a lot of him offensively. I think he's been kind of struggling, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned him, Nick. I was just looking at his contract status the other day. He's having a bad year at the plate, and he's actually been kind of trending downward for the last few years, but the defense still rates well, and he's on a one-year deal with the Twins right now, so maybe that is an option.
Could be. I feel like he accepted more money last year, too. Probably still teams still banking on that turnaround, and so maybe another down year at the plate, maybe you can get him for like super cheap, and that could be an option as well, but if you go that route, then you better be putting that money in the pitching staff, which I know is a whole podcast episode in of itself.
It's a whole month of podcast episodes.
True.
we could dive really deep on that. So building off of this topic, we'll bring up a listener question that we got from our patron group, which is, which players from our top 50 will be trade candidates when the Orioles are ready to buy instead of sell? I have my own thoughts about this, but I'll let Bob or Nick start first before I chime in.
I had such a hard time with this question just because it's hard to say, okay, a year from now when I think we'll be ready to do something like this, who's going to be, you know, it's tough. I'm guessing it could be one of the 2021 draftees that is like 8 outfielders, so maybe a John Rhodes or a Reed Trimble type, but I hate to say it, maybe Kyle Stowers has enough helium, and with his strikeout numbers, maybe that's, especially the way they like emphasized not striking out in this year's draft and at the lower levels, maybe that's someone that they would be willing to let go in the right deal. But I hope not, because I really like following him. But I don't know. What do you guys think?
I mean, it is a tough question. I think it's question better suited to answer this probably next year when Rodriguez and Rutschman are up, and I think Westberg and Henderson and D.L. Hall are close to the majors, and we see what the Orioles are going to do this offseason as far as trades and free agents. But I mean, I guess just looking at our list, you know, if I think Joey Ortiz could end up being one of those options. Maybe. I know we just talked about him being a potential starter with the Orioles, but I think if you look at Jordan Westberg, Gunnar Henderson, Joey Ortiz, those three guys, like one of them could be an option that you move. And I hope it's not Gunnar Henderson. I'm hoping he is the starter of the future for many, many years, but you know, hopefully one of those guys isn't going to pan out. Two of those guys may not pan out, but I know MLB Pipeline, I think, did a piece of one prospect that could be traded from each team, and they listed Jordan Westberg as their option. But Ortiz is an elite defender, and so if you like what Westberg and Henderson are doing, Ortiz brings value. And I was also thinking, like, some of these younger catchers, maybe. Like, I know Sammy Basalo and Creed Willems, they're very, very young. They're projectable. They're power hitters. They probably don't project as catchers as you move them up the ranks, but still, I mean, maybe they could be attractive pieces to throw into a deal to land you some major league pitching. You know, I would hate to trade away all these young guys, but if your infield core, if you can find that between Henderson, Westberg, and some other guys, then even a Michael Hernandez becomes expendable. I know I don't want to deal away those young international talents either right now, but I mean, that's why we're signing them. That's why we're building this pipeline, is to have tradable assets as well. And so those guys, I'm looking probably more at the younger guys because they're going to have the most value. But the guys at the upper levels right now, they've got to hit. Some of these guys have to start hitting. Otherwise, then you know, we're going off the rails a little bit.
And the idea of raising the floor and building this depth is to eventually trade from it and still be fine, you know, everywhere and have your bases covered. So, yeah, it's so hard to tell. I think in a year or two with all these outfielders, all these infielders slash shortstops, It could be anyone. Anthony Servidio, maybe he bounces back big time next year, but we already have Ortiz, et cetera, et cetera, and then he becomes tradable. So it's too early to tell, I think. Yeah. But this is a podcast, so let's talk about it anyway.
Yeah.
I was going to say, it's exciting, though, because, like, let's say Westberg, he seems like a pretty safe bet if we're going to bet on these guys hitting into the next level. He seems safe. So if you got Westbury, you got Mountcastle at first base, you got Henderson at shortstop or third base, you've got some free agent maybe thrown in there. Michael Hernandez is still down there in high A maybe now, and he's raking in 2 years, and he looks like a fantastic prospect. Everyone seems to be super high on him. Even outside the organization seems to be high on him. That's a guy who can land you a solid major league starting pitcher, and you're not hurt at all because you still got some other guys coming up through the system. So it is exciting to think about.
Hopefully you signed other guys like Anderson, De Los Santos, and blah, blah, blah to pick up the slack if you happen to trade one of them.
Yeah, I feel like in the here and now, the easiest way to answer the question is look at where there's the most depth in the system and look at where there are guys that are possibly 4 years away from the big leagues at this point. And the younger they are, the further away they are from the majors, probably the more likely they are to be traded. I think that, you know, if you look back at the discussion we just had about off-season trade targets, I don't know that any of the players we mentioned would require any player above, say, 20th in the farm system to bring in. Number may even be lower than that. So when you start to look ahead, though, when the Orioles really are contending, it's probably going to be a guy that right now is on the lower end of that list, but that by the time the Orioles are ready to pull the trigger on a big move to make a trade, is in the top 10 or top 15. So I would say that as a rule for right now, that's where I would look, is down lower in the system where you have players that are 4 or 5 years away and there are a lot of prospects in front of them. There's a lot of depth at that position already. So we know, for instance, the Orioles have coveted center fielders in the last few years. That's a deep position. Second base is a deep position. Shortstop is a deep position. So the up the middle spots right now, even catcher's deep. So the up the middle spots right now are deep. That would probably be a good place to start, but I think that we're probably a year or two away from really knowing the answer to that question.
Yeah.
And the exciting thing is we're pretty deep everywhere, honestly.
Yeah, I was just looking at that list too. As you mentioned, guys at the bottom of the list, I mean, even in Anthony Servidio, I mean, way down there, I know his season was cut very short this year, but that's a guy who, coming out of the draft, evaluator said that glove is pretty much major league ready right now. And so, like, teams are going to find that attractive, and that's going to add value. And so there are definitely pieces they can move right now, I think. But next year, I think, is the year that you really start paying attention, and then we start probably having to say some goodbyes to some guys we've really fallen in love with, but that's okay because this major league roster is going to get better.
Look, we all love him, but Michel Desaulne, with all the, you know, fast riser college outfielders that we have, is he a guy that could be expendable in a year?
Gene Pinto.
I hope not. Oh, no, no, don't even say that. I will not hear that slander.
So we will now move on to our final segment of the show where we talk about a player outside of our top 30. And it could be a good week. Well, no, but in this case, it's just a good season because the season's over for most teams. So this week, what we're going to do is mix it up a bit. And each of us picked two. We picked a position player and a pitcher that we wanted to discuss in the final segment. And I'll start with Bob, who went towards the upper levels of the system for his picks.
Yeah, really, I lean towards guys who ended the year strong. And obviously, Tyler Nevin, who is my position player, he's still going. He's two more weeks left in the season. But just wanted to mention, over his last 15 days of play, he's batting .311 with a .992 OPS. And it seems like he's had a pretty rough year, especially in the middle there. But looking at his numbers, he had the lowest batting average for balls on play in his career at just .251. He doesn't strike out much, just right around 20%, which these days is not bad at all. And he's got like a 9% walk rate, which is solid. So I still think there's a little bit of promise there. And I think he kind of saved his season a little bit over the last few weeks. And hopefully he can keep that going into the next couple weeks.
Yeah, it was really good to see him in the season on a hot streak. And there is still 10 games left, so still more time for him. But the power is there. You mentioned those numbers. I pointed out the BABIP as well when I was looking at his stuff. So it's not like Ryland Bannon BABIP, which I think was like barely cracking 100 a couple minutes ago. So you're still looking at like a, let's say, best case scenario, a 240, 250 hitter probably for Nevin. The defense, he's competent at a lot of his positions. He plays first, third, left, right. He's competent for like a week or two, and then he'll go on a stretch where he makes some plays that are just like so extremely frustrating. So the defense is a big question mark, but he adds value with that positional versatility. So it's going to be interesting to see. I thought maybe if Mancini was going to be done for the year, maybe we saw Tyler Nevin come up, finish the year at Baltimore. But yeah, I think I'd like to see him up to win a spot next year on next year's major league roster, to fill out a couple of positions as depth, and let's see what you got. And if you don't have it by the All-Star break, then, you know, they're still Terran Baver and Desaulne in the system to win that trade.
Yep.
Yeah, there. You know, I think that depending on what happens in the major league roster over the offseason, there is probably room for Nevin because he's a guy that can play both infield and outfield corners. And the thing that Bob touched on is his strikeout and walk rates. He's really been that hitter his whole career, draws a lot of walks, doesn't strike out a ton. And the fact that he hasn't completely strayed from that in the middle of a really up-and-down year at Norfolk is an encouraging sign for me. The question mark that I think we've had with Nevin for a while is he going to hit for enough power to be at one of those spots every day? But, you know, if he can come up and hit, you know, as Nick said, 250, 260, give you a good on-base percentage, play a few different spots, I think there's a role in the majors for him.
Yeah, probably not ever like an everyday player, but certainly a role player, bench guy. Certainly doesn't hurt. If we do trade Trey Mancini this offseason, I would think he's got the front of the line there to be the at least play a part in the DH role early in 2022. But I'll go with my pitcher now, and that's another guy who, after it's Gray Fenter for the record, after his first 10 starts where he had a 8.73 ERA over 33 innings and a 1.76 whip. I was kind of like, oh, he lost it. Not good. Don't have to pay attention to him anymore. And now just looking at, he's got his ERA down to 5.47 for the year, thanks to a 3.05 ERA over his last 11 starts, covering 44.1 innings, 1.38 whip. He's still walking too many guys, 27 over that span, but he's got 53 Ks, so his strikeouts are going back up. His FIP is even a little bit better than that, 5.26 xFIP. The real issue with him is his strikeouts are down a little bit, his walks are up a little bit, but his home run to fly ball rate is really a lot higher than it has been in his career. So just an interesting season for him after he got picked in the Rule 5, and then I kind of gave up on him after a terrible first half, but maybe he is regaining some value as a potential reliever here. I don't know if he can survive the offseason. I doubt he gets picked in Rule 5 again, but I don't know if he's a minor league free agent or what the deal is with that.
I had written him off too. I saw him in Richmond early on in the year, and that was a stretch where, like, his first inning, he would get shelled for 4 or 5 runs, and then would throw, like, 3 scoreless after that. But it was always that first inning he could never get out of. He's also, to his credit, watching Bowie at the end of this year, he's had to overcome a lot of just terrible umpiring. And I'm not just saying that because the umpires never call Orioles games or Bay Sox games correctly. Like, it's been some significantly bad umpiring that Bowie's had to deal with, and it seems to always come when Fenter starts. And Fenter isn't someone that I'm stressing over, like, if he gets squeezed or, like, has a lot of bad calls go his way, but he's overcome those. He's stayed poised out there on the mound and finished his outing. So it's good to see him finish strong. And I do like what Bob said there, that it's going to be tough to see, like, does he come back in the organization next year? Is he maybe in Norfolk's bullpen to start the year, or do the Orioles go ahead and part ways with him? Because, you know, but at least he was able to turn things around, and because it seemed like Chicago Cubs, like, really destroyed this man.
Yeah, you know, he came back from the Cubs after they let him go in spring training and really struggled out of the gate at Bowie. And it had me questioning, should he even be in Bowie? Because we last saw him in Delmarva in 2019, and he's struggled with injuries throughout his career. Maybe Bowie was too aggressive of a move, despite the fact he had time in major league camp with the Cubs. But yeah, he did settle down as the year went on, which was a good sign. It will be interesting to see whether or not they bring him back, or if this is another Brian Gonzalez situation where, all right, a guy, you know, did well, kind of ended things on a high note a little bit, although Gonzalez, it was just based off of reports you're hearing at the alt site, but, you know, ends on a high note a little bit, maybe he's able to get picked up by somebody else. Personally, I would like to see him back just to see, you know, if you did move him to the bullpen, which is something we talked about a while ago on this show. What would he look like as a reliever? And I would be curious to see that. But regardless, it was good to see him rebound and put together a strong finish after such a tough start at Bowie. And hopefully he continues that tomorrow night in game one of the playoffs.
Yeah, they're going to need him. I want to see Bowie win this series so bad. Just give these guys a ring. And it would be cool to see Fenter. I guess I can go with my picks while we wait for Bob to hop back on, hopefully. I've got my hitter first is a guy that I know we talked about before we came on the air. We were talking about him briefly, but Darryl Hernández, he went 10 for 24 last week in Delmarva. That's a 417 average with a 940 OPS. He finished the year with an 18-game on-base streak, had a hit in 15 of those. Like, I want to reach out to someone in Delmarva, an instructor down there, and ask someone who's a lot smarter than I am about his season, because I'm having difficulties in, like, creating my final, like, overarching takeaway from Hernández's season. He had the long on-base streaks, but the OPS is only 690, only 18 extra base hits. And as we mentioned a few times, the walks just weren't there. He's clearly hitting the ball well when he gets his pitches, but it seems to be like a lot of singles. And I don't know if there's a Joey Ortiz breakout in there or exactly like what went on with him this year, because I want to say it was a really good season for him. But at the same time, like, you look at the numbers and there was a lot of, you know, not so great eye popping numbers for him. And so I need someone smarter than me to kind of break down his season, I think.
Yeah, his season is one of those that is tough to break down, because you remember back in what was then the Gulf Coast League in 2019, Hernández walked all the time. This year, it seemed like he barely drew a walk. Also was not striking out very much, which I take as an encouraging sign. Really, the things for him going forward are going to be, does that walk rate come back, or was what we saw in 2019 really not indicative of who he is as a hitter? And what does the power projection look like? That's one thing we've heard about a lot with Hernández, is that he's a younger, kind of projectable guy. Maybe he has at least a little bit more doubles power in him, if not home run power. But like you said, Nick, you don't want to put too much hope into a lot of on-base streaks and a lot of singles. So there are some question marks for me with Hernández, but there's some definite positives here. And I think overall, despite some of the, despite the lack of walks, despite, you know, maybe the lack of power, kind of have positive takeaways for the most part from Hernández this season.
Yeah, I think overall it's positive, but yeah, go ahead, Bob.
Sorry, I had to pop off for a second. There was a bit of a crisis, but I think Hernández could be a projective breakout candidate, a la Joey Ortiz. I think I've said that a few times this year, just because he's got such a projectable frame. You can just see it. There's muscle to be had there. His jersey is definitely a little baggy on him. But I just like to see the way he ended the season. Definitely, I'm sure you mentioned it, but would love to see that walk rate get back to 2019 levels. And hopefully, you know, as he moves up to Aberdeen, we've seen that's where players start to walk more, at least with Gunnar Henderson and stuff like that. So maybe next year he could be a breakout guy who gets that walk rate back, puts on a little bit of power, and can play some pretty good infield and hit for an average.
Yeah, and I just looked. He just turned 20 back in August, so he's going to play pretty much all next year as a 20-year-old as well. So, yeah, definitely still lots of time with him. My pitcher is Zach Peake. I mean, just one of the biggest risers in our updated top 50 list, which you can only find if you're a patron. Our initial list is up on BaltimoreSportsLife.com, and we expanded it to 50, but that was from right after the draft. We've updated it since on September 1st for patrons, and Peake was one of the bigger risers. I think he rises again, possibly, when we do one of our final updates of 2021 here in a couple of days. But his last start was 5 innings, 2 hits, no runs, 2 walks, 6 strikeouts. Over his last 4 starts, he is at 20 innings, so 5 innings each outing, only 4 runs with 27 strikeouts. And I've got an easy question for you guys, of any guesses on who leads the all Orioles minor league pitchers in strikeouts. And hint, it's not Mickey Janis or Dean Kramer.
I thought you were going to ask any guesses who we're going to interview on the show next week, but I'm guessing it's Zach Peake for both of those.
It is. It's Grayson Rodriguez. It is for who we're interviewing next week, which I cannot wait for. But Grayson Rodriguez leads the organization in strikeouts, but second place on that list is Zach Peake. So only Grayrod has more strikeouts than Zach Peake in the Orioles system. Pretty much literally no one else is talking about this guy, and I think it's a shame. I'm very excited to talk about him for sure. And that was a day, too. That start also came on a day where Kyle Bradish had a fantastic outing, drew Rom through 5 perfect innings. Do you want an instance of the cupboard is full here in Baltimore? Like, that day last week was a perfect example. And I know that's just one day, but that's pretty indicative of how I think their seasons have gone overall.
Yeah, even Carlos Tavera had pretty good outing that day. It was a beautiful day.
Yeah, Peake was really impressive this year. And that was a guy that we didn't have a lot to go on coming into this year because he had not pitched professionally. Came over in the Bundy trade for the 2020 season. Obviously didn't get to pitch then, but everything that I saw with Zach Peake this year, I liked. I liked what he was doing with the secondaries. The fastball looked great. And, you know, he's one of those guys that right now, if you said to me, what is his floor and what is his ceiling? The floor is pretty high, and the ceiling, I think, seems to be getting a little bit higher. I think the floor with him is good middle to late inning reliever. I think the ceiling is probably that he's a starter somewhere down the line. So he's really, to me, a guy that rose so much this year that I'm just excited to see him at Bowie next year, hopefully doing more of this.
Yeah, I think a lot of people were calling for him to be promoted to Bowie earlier this year, which I think was a fair, something fair that people wanted to see. I think he could have made a couple starts for Bowie this year, but we'll ask him about that maybe.
Yeah, I definitely agree, Zach. I think his floor basically at this point is a pretty solid reliever. I mean, his stuff is pretty wicked. And if he can get the command even better than it already is, then maybe he is a guy that can stick in the starting rotation. But no matter what, he's definitely a good one to have in the cupboard, as they say.
So for my picks tonight, I'll just go with another pitcher in that cupboard, and a guy that you really should be paying attention to, especially with the way he's pitched over the last month or so, and that is Brandon Young, who put together a really impressive season between Delmarva and Aberdeen, and another product of that undrafted free agent class of 2020. Between the two levels, 84 and a third innings pitch, 3.52 ERA. And in that stretch, he strikes out 114 batters against 37 walks. He was actually a little bit, seemingly a little bit better at times at Aberdeen, striking out 54 batters in 37 innings there, and ended the season on a high note, putting together a really good September. I'm going to pull up the numbers here right now that I just had, and then for some reason hit the back button on. So 15 in the third innings, 19 strikeouts, 7 walks, 2.93 ERA. So a really good season for the 23-year-old right-hander and a guy that's probably ticketed for Bowie next year, when coming into this year, we had little to no information about Brandon Young as a pitcher. And look at him now.
Yeah, I think John Mioli mentioned that the organization's pretty up on him, pretty high on him right now. And he certainly ended the year strong. Talk about a guy who could be a riser on our October update for our top 50 prospect list. I mean, this is a guy who really finished the year strong, only gave up one hit last week over eight innings with 13 strikeouts. Pretty electric stuff. I got to see him. He didn't have his best outing when I saw him with Aberdeen, but the stuff is legit. You can just see it. So excited about him next year for sure.
Yeah, I'm appointing myself as the president of the Brandon Young fan club. I love this guy. I was excited to watch him close the year strong in high A as well. You know, he did pitch better, I think. The strikeout rate jumped like 5% up to 35% in high A. The walks ticked down a little bit. You mentioned the ERA was 3.89, but the FIP and XFIP were even lower, down in like the low threes. So all good numbers for him. And it was encouraging too to hear, like, I think it was his last start in Delmarva was statistically one of his worst starts of the season. But as Sam Jelinek, voice of the Shorebirds, you know, he responded to one of our tweets after that start and said, look, you know, Young actually told him that that was the best he felt all year. And then he was rewarded after that terrible start, though, with a promotion to high A right after that. Had one, you know, adjustment start, got roughed up a little bit, but then pretty much put it on cruise control for the rest of the season there in high A. So many more steps for him to go, but I'm great. I love watching him pitch. I think it's one of his coaches that like responds to every single one of our tweets about Brandon Young, like best changeup in the country. And I think his curveball is actually, that's the pitch that I think that stands out the most for sure. But yeah, as soon as the Orioles announced that they had signed Young last year, I watched one of his college starts. I fell in love instantly. And so I'm happy to see him have some success early on.
So my pick for hitters is a guy you've heard a lot about this summer. And that's Misael De Sohn. He wrapped up the Florida Complex League with a 930 OPS. And this is a guy who just turned 19 back in July, showing some real speed right now. And with a frame of 6'3", 155, according to his baseball reference listing, certainly has room to fill out and hit for more power. Earned a late season promotion to Delmarva, but we didn't get to see him much when he was there. Only appeared in six games, but he's now in a position where he will be a 19-year-old starting center fielder in low A next year, which is really a good thing to see. I love the speed. I love the instincts that he has in center field. He's got a lot of speed right now, but he hits with enough authority to make me believe that as he does fill out a little bit, we're going to see those power numbers tick up a little bit. I don't know what his ceiling is as far as home runs go, but I know that he's going to hit for more power as he starts to fill out. So De Sohn is a guy that if he was not on your radar before the season, he should be now, because for my money, he had one of the best seasons, the lower minors this year.
Yeah. And I love what the Orioles did with him here the last couple of weeks, even though he only played in six games, picked up a couple hits, a couple RBIs, just let him get a taste of what he's up for next year. Give him some motivation heading into the off season, you know, hit the weights and get the drills in. And I think he could really put up a great season and work his way up to Aberdeen. And I think he'll be like barely 20 years old at that point. So love this kid. Love everything we've seen from him this year. And hopefully he continues it next year.
And I think I saw earlier a couple of days ago, like he was one of, if not the top statistical like hitter in the Florida Complex League this year. So good positives there. You know, we didn't get to see a whole lot of him in Delmarva, but I think what we did see, he was clearly a very raw prospect still, but you saw the speed, you got a sense of the energy that he brings to the game. It was kind of pretty obvious that he was kind of like wide-eyed out there on the field, being a young teenager with very little pro experience, but he's going to settle in. Like we mentioned before, it's important to be patient with guys like De Sohn who are in that position. Very young, missed a year when they're 17, 18 years old, key developmental year, so he's going to be 19. He doesn't turn 20 until July. So he's going to spend most of the year as a 19-year-old in Delmarva. It's a great way. He can just sit back and relax and take it easy. Not take it easy like that, Delmarva. But like, there's no rush for De Sohn. Plenty of time for him to develop down there next year.
Absolutely. So that does it for us this week. Be sure to continue to follow us on Twitter at BSL on the Verge. Check out BaltimoreSportsAndLife.com for the latest Orioles coverage and of your winning Baltimore Ravens after last night. Who doesn't want to read some Ravens coverage? So head over to BaltimoreSportsAndLife.com to check that out. Be sure to join the message board, hop into the discussions about the Orioles, Ravens, and more. We'll be back next week with Zach Peak, Orioles farm system reliever or pitcher, sorry. And for our listeners in Canada, if you've not voted yet, go ahead and do it. The polls are still open, apparently. So for Bob Phelan and Nick Stevens, this is Zach Sweden. You've been listening to On the Verge.